then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal, token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 27th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons hung their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my boys, for freedom is the rising of the moon.
In last week's broadcast, we talked about the 9 month syndrome, a movement phenomenon where after about 9 months, our new people get bored because there are no immediate spectacular results like assassinations or an ongoing revolution, and there's nobody in their area who's willing to meet with them. Well, probably there is, but they're all too paralyzed with fear to come forward. I still can't get over the fact that all during those years when Jeff Hughes was begging and pleading for somebody up in Vancouver to step forward and help him, there was a Stormfront poster living across the street from Jeff and who actually witnessed part of Jeff's murder by the RCMP, and yet who continues to hide behind his computer to this day. Sorry, got off onto a tirade. Where was I? Anyway, basically, after a few months, a lot of white people with short American attention spans are used to demanding the instant gratification of every desire, get bored with the Northwest idea once they find out it's actually hard to move to the homeland, and they wander away looking for other entertainment. Last week, I asked you guys out there to tell me, honestly and up front, exactly what it is that you want to see from me and from the Northwest Front that will keep you from getting bored. I got some pretty good responses, and this one is from Mark in Illinois. Dear Harold, just finished listening to the most recent podcast. You asked for suggestions as to what you should speak about. I'm very much impressed by your intelligence, but even more so, as compared to Dr. Pierce, by your down-home, folksy, and humorous approach. I chuckle out loud at least once every time I listen to a podcast. Well, you'd be chuckling even more if I didn't edit out all my burps and sneezes and whatnot. Anyway, getting back to Mark's letter, you are a rare one of our breed, a creative, artsy white nationalist who, unlike Dr. Pierce, can speak to the common man in our movement. The major takeaway I have from your broadcasts is the need to educate us on what it is like, really, to be a serious-minded political soldier of the European variety, the Irish nationalist, the South African nationalist, etc. You have had direct exposure to these people. We must, as simple-minded, materialistic Americans, learn to become serious political soldiers. Give us, in your podcasts, that sense. To hell with white dating sites and esoteric questions about abortion or the morality of homosexuality. Tell us from your direct experience of the men and women you knew in Ireland or South Africa, with your artist's eye, of their methods and mental attitudes. Help us become the gravely serious political soldiers that we must become, men inured to hardship, willing to die for the ideals of race and nation. As members of a group who represents the most serious challenge to the regime's authority, the Northwest Front, we must learn to become practical, serious men. In the search for our homeland, we must learn practical and emotional fighting techniques to survive and endure as those soldiers of the various European movements have done so in the past. How do we fight for the homeland and deal with our broken and sometimes hostile families, for example? How do we hold down a day job but at night have enough energy and motivation to continue the struggle? You've been there and seen this. Help us to become even more effective. These are insights that perhaps only you can share with the current movement. This is what I'd like to hear from you. Okay, Mark, where to begin? I'll try to address everything you raised in your email as briefly as I can, but these are some really complicated topics. The obvious answer is that the men I knew in the Rhodesian Army and the people I observed in Ireland from the sidelines back in the 1980s were very much a different kind of white person from white Americans. Both lots had their faults, many faults, but make no mistake, we're not talking Beavis and Butthead here. That's what makes my job so hard. Most of you people out there honestly have no idea what I'm talking about because you've never yourselves known any other life besides liberal American political correctness. You've had it drummed into your heads that the present situation is eternal and immutable, that liberal democracy is the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama says. And with all due respect, I honestly don't think most of you really believe that any different kind of world or life is possible. And of course, as long as you believe that, you're right, it isn't possible. First off, the people I knew in Rhodesia and Ireland did share one thing in common with me. We were both born and raised in the last of our respective old ways, the old British Empire way in Africa and the old traditional Catholic Irish way in Ireland before the church was exposed as a nest of bugger boys, exposed with some justification, I don't deny, but with a lot more to do with the left-wing Jewish agenda of destroying Roman Catholicism, which is a topic I won't get into because that is way too deep a subject for just a few minutes of babbling. Never mind. Fact was, when I was in Ireland, the church was still very much in the saddle. Getting back to the difference between white Africans and Americans, I won't say that they were raised without television, because they did see some, and there were certainly Hollywood movies in their youth, which can be almost as harmful, but certainly not the harmful level of television that exists today. And they were certainly very lucky to be raised without the internet. In South Africa, the National Party apartheid government very wisely did not allow television into the country at all until the late 1970s, for the very reason that they recognized it as a corrupting influence. In Rhodesia, there was only one channel, the RBC, and the TV only broadcast for only about maybe 6 hours at night, mostly news and old movies and a few American sitcoms they got hold of somehow. We didn't have VCRs and DVDs in those days, so that was pretty much it. The first TV show I ever saw in Rhodesia, in the hotel lounge in Salisbury, was an old sitcom called Nanny and the Professor. When I was at Llewellyn Barracks, the African laborers used to watch the TV over at the RAR barracks, and their favorite show was Batman, the old TV series from the 60s. I was rather bemused when some of our Kaffirs over at the Ordnance Depot, who knew I was American, asked me if I'd ever been to Gotham City and seen Batman tooling around in the Batmobile. But you have to understand that most Rhodesians, unless they were immigrants from Britain, had seen very little television in their lives. So that was an immense help. They hadn't had their brains sautéed and pulverized by 6 hours of poisoned Jutube every day. In Ireland, of course, they grew up with the telly, BBC and ITV and all that crap, but in the 60s and 70s, when things got hot in the north, the level of liberal poison in British and Irish TV wasn't quite as bad as it is today. They had some American imports, but at first, at least, it wasn't the really filthy stuff out of Hollywood. Of course, above all, the IRA and UVF men of that era didn't have the internet where they could let off steam harmlessly into cyberspace. The Irish also grew up poor, probably the poorest white people in the world outside of Appalachia and maybe Mississippi. Darndale in Dublin and the Gorbals in Glasgow were at one stage the worst white slums in the world. In some of those row houses in Belfast, they didn't even have indoor plumbing. They still had the old water closet out in the back garden and the big steel tub for the bath on Saturday night. White people who don't grow up in the lap of luxury don't get anywhere near as corrupted as Americans do. A large part of our American apathy is not just cowardice, but simple laziness due to the incredible level of personal luxury that even to this day we enjoy. You have to have lived in Europe like the Europeans themselves do, like I've done, in bedsitters and council housing estates, to understand just how incredibly rich and luxurious and spacious American life is. That's the first thing you notice about British flats and whatnot. The rooms are so tiny. I remember as recently as 1992, when I was working at Morgan Grenfell in London, one of my British co-workers came back from a couple of weeks of holiday that he'd spent in the United States, in Orlando at Disney World, of course. The Brits are fascinated with Disney World. And in the tea room, he was regaling us all with a story of some restaurant he'd gone to in Florida that was an Aladdin's cave of food, offering huge salads with 2 dozen ingredients and soup and 5 or 6 meat dishes, so forth and so on. And I realized that what he was talking about was a Golden Corral buffet, something Americans take for granted. And yet this British guy was absolutely freaked out by all that choice. He'd never seen anything like it. He probably consumed more meat and protein that night in one sitting than he would normally eat in 2 weeks in London. Working-class Brits actually live mostly on beer, grain, and starch of various kinds, beans and potatoes, whatnot. Their sausages are about half flour, and their sandwiches have one slice of thin cold-cut or processed cheese. Plus, they put butter on their sandwiches and sugar on popcorn, and they don't even get me started on eels and Marmite. Sorry, I'm Grandpa Simpson rambling again. Anyway, you really have no idea just how much material luxury American white people wallow in compared to everyone else in the world, and it doesn't do well for building our character. So that's the first difference between Americans today and the white Africans and later the Irish that I knew. They grew up in an environment that, if it wasn't necessarily physically or emotionally hard, was significantly less materially oriented and luxurious than that of white Americans, and they had a lot more opportunity to develop their mental and moral outlooks and capacities without the constant distractions of Game Boy and MTV and Pokemon and all that Judaic pablum of the mind. For example, when my children were going to school in Ireland, they were still required to read actual books, not get all their material online, and for all I know, that may even still be the case, although I know it's not in the UK. Secondly, the white Africans and the Irish of, I won't say my generation, but the ones I observed in my time in their countries grew up when important things were still speakable. You could and did actually talk about such things as the facts of race or politics, and it was entirely expected that you would have a partisan point of view. Having opinions to the right of center wasn't the self-destructive heresy it is in this country today. None of this business we have in America today where certain sensitive topics having to do with race and Israel and Zionism and Barack Obama are literally unspeakable for fear of offending someone and meeting either violent psychotic retaliation from a nigger or crushing economic retaliation from a Jew or a liberal in the form of loss of employment. None of this business of white people having to look over their shoulder and lower their voices to a whisper whenever they speak about something racial for fear that someone will overhear, a Jew or a nigger or, what's worse, some goddamn egg-suck white liberal who'll go running to report another white man to the company or to the authorities for a politically incorrect remark. That is the first mark of life in a police state. That quick little glance over your shoulder to see who's listening before you speak. It happens every day with white people in America, and of course today it happens to white people in South Africa and Ireland. But it didn't used to. White Africans and Irish on both sides of the Troubles were able to be physically brave and take direct action to some extent because when they were growing up, their minds and emotions hadn't been crippled by being refused permission to speak. Remember, speech is always the first step to action, which is why Western regimes fear it so, and why here in America they're so desperate to find some way around the First Amendment so they can start locking up political opponents, to the point of imprisoning Bill White for posting public record information on his website and arresting that poor kid in Kentucky for posting a poem to the internet. They know that if we become afraid to speak political incorrectness, that someday we will be afraid even to think it, which is what they ultimately want. It's thought control. White people today live in a state of fear and ignorance. You would be amazed at how many American whites believe that it's actually illegal to say anything racial out loud or write anything politically incorrect. And one can understand that when we see someone getting fired from their job for sending a so-called racially charged email. These people in the other lands I lived in didn't have to grow up with that. In Africa, you obviously can't avoid talking about race since you live with it every day. There's no escape from the subject. In Belfast, ditto on the subject of armed struggle since it's going on all around you and Pandora's box has already been opened. Northern Ireland wasn't like here, where everybody is still sitting around, hunkered down behind their computers, waiting for somebody else to go first. In Ireland, somebody already did go first, back in 1916, and so the cat was already out of the bag. Finally, there is the obvious difference that in white Africa and in Ireland in the 1950s and 1960s, most young white boys were raised in traditional two-parent families where they had a father as a strong male role model and a mother to give emotional and moral balance to their characters, and that no longer applies. Many, if not most, young white people today are raised either in single-parent families or else in households with one partner in the relationship who's a step-parent, and the partners may not even be married to each other. I don't think it's possible to overstate the terrible effect that the destruction of the traditional nuclear family has had on several generations of white children. It's difficult to assess just which of our many problems causes what percentage of our many weaknesses, including cowardice and laziness, but absence of a stable two-parent family unit certainly is a large contributory factor. Okay, Dragging myself kicking and screaming back in the direction of Mark's original question, how can we white Americans in the early 21st century become like these other men I knew in my youth, men who were born about the same time as I was, but who grew up in other countries in environments which were largely absent the kind, or at least the level, of moral poison constantly spewing from the Jew tube and the whole counterculture thing? Or, as I have put it myself in the past, how can we become the kind of men our great-grandfathers were? Again, this is an advantage I have in visiting two of the last white societies remaining in the world before they were destroyed. You might say I was able to meet our great-grandfathers, and so America's past is very much more real to me. How do we transform ourselves? How do we get rid of all the poison that the Jews have dumped into us since birth? This question mark is probably the purest essence of the message I'm trying to convey and which I've been trying to get across for decades now. There simply is no 25 words or less answer. When my computer got a bad virus in January, there was no way I could get rid of it with any existing software. The infection was in too deep to be removed. I was fortunate in that I had a very computer-savvy comrade living in the area here who was able to help me. But what he had to do was format the whole hard drive and do a complete rebuild from the ground up. Now that's what we have to do with our hearts, minds, and souls, Mark. I will most likely spend the rest of my life trying to answer your question, trying to explain how to do that complete rebuild. I think I know, but it's very hard for me to put all of this in words. Every time I do, I'm going to fail to connect with most people because the common language and experience simply won't be there, but I will never stop trying. But I will stop for the first music break. I'm still looking for a good version of the horse whistle song, but surprise, surprise, I haven't been able to find one, which is not surprising since you can go to prison for even singing it out loud on a street corner at pub closing time anywhere in Germany or Austria, and anyone who dared to sing and record a modern version of it would probably be buried alive in some coal mine in the Ruhr or something of the kind. I've also been hunting around for a good, modern, properly digitally mixed version of the old German battle hymn Ich hatte einen Kameraden, but once again, all we can find so far is old Third Reich versions, which is odd since that one isn't especially associated with the Third Reich, I don't think. It's from the Napoleonic Wars originally, and it has associations with the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and World War I, as well as with the Hitler era. But unless the German Zionist regime has decided to ban even that part of their country's history, you'd think there would be some post-1945 versions of the song somewhere. We just can't seem to find any so far on the internet. Let's face it, the recording quality in the 1930s simply wasn't what it is today. One of our guys did find an old version of Ich hatte einen Kameraden from the war, and he did some remixing on it, which improved the sound considerably, but he was basically working off a 70-year-old mono recording, and I'm still not happy with it quality-wise. It sounds like the band is playing underwater. And to our nitpickety modern ears that are used to woofers and tweeters and bass lines and digital poop-de-doo to make electronic whigger banging sound like actual music, it would probably get the reaction of, like that old-time stuff sounds like crap, man. That really sucks. Oh, by the way, if anyone can locate a modern and reasonably well-done version of Lily Marlene in German, that might also be a candidate for our oldies but goodies section here on Radio Free Northwest. Anyway, one of our electronic impresarios, Colonel House, did manage to find a modern version of Panzerlied, the Panzer song, and God knows how that one was able to escape from the German censors. You remember the Germans singing in the old war movie Battle of the Bulge? That's the one. The Colonel also added some pretty cool, appropriate sound effects. This is Panzerlied.
Oder war es Gott die Nacht?
Now, Mark, since I have wandered way far afield from your original email, let me go over the last part of it again. How do we fight for the homeland and deal with our broken and sometimes hostile families, for example? How do we hold down a day job but at night have enough energy and motivation to continue the struggle? You've been there and seen this. Help us to become even more effective. As far as holding down a day job, you do that because you have to. One of the worst things about this society, I say that a lot, don't I? The thing is, there's so many terrible things about American life that one hardly knows where to begin. Anyway, one of the more notably repulsive things about American society is that creative, intelligent, and versatile human beings are forced to get up every day when a damn bell or buzzer goes off, put on scratchy clothes they hate. If you're a man, you may be forced to wrap a piece of cloth around your neck like a noose, and then you have to drive through filthy hot traffic in the summer and pitch blackness in the winter to get to some stupid place where you have to spend 8 hours doing stupid bird brain things with stupid bird brain people you despise. Usually complicated by affirmative action and infantile workplace politics, and you're forced to do all this simply to survive. It's one of the things that really messes up our personalities and warps our minds to the point where we become unbalanced. Virtually none of us in the movement, such as it is, have any choice. Even those of us who are in fact qualified to do serious academic or business or scientific or medical related things usually are not allowed to make a living in our actual professions for a variety of reasons, most of which are not our fault, and have to do with the whole affirmative action system, and also on occasion with various types of retaliation for past political and personal indiscretions. But you have to do it unless you're independently wealthy. And if that's the case, please email me at nwnet@earthlink.net because I want some of that independent wealth to finance the revolutionary independence movement here in the Northwest. I've done all of that in the past. Believe me, people, I've paid my dues. In my time, I have been a pizza cook, a cab driver, a warehouse mule of every description, an agricultural laborer, and I managed a bowling alley. I've also been a bookstore owner, a survey taker, a bootlegger, an actor, a radio newsreader, 50 kinds of Stockton storeroom clerk, 50 kinds of general paper shuffling clerk, a computer tech support monkey, and a professional fundraiser for a Jew. Don't ask. Actually, I've worked for Jews twice in my life, but I got the first bunch in Charleston back. I wrote a book about them. The worst thing I ever did was about 2 years I spent in insurance in the late 1980s, during which I had to get a couple of licenses and professional qualifications, for which I had to study and pass exams. Now, have you ever had to sit down and actually think about insurance? It is an agony of the mind comparable to getting nails driven through your kneecaps. And during all this time, the minute I got off work and got home, I started doing something racial, even if it was only reading a politically incorrect book. You have to do all this day job crap because politically correct society makes you do it in order to survive. You cannot be effective and do anything at all for your race and your civilization while you're living under a bridge or in a Salvation Army homeless shelter. You do what you have to do, and that includes working a day job that most likely bores you to the point of gibbering insanity, if you're lucky enough to have one, that is. These days, one out of every 5 white males isn't so lucky. It's just one of those things that comes with the territory, and I've always accepted it. Now, as to dealing with hostile family, yes, this is a very common movement phenomenon. In fact, it's so common that one might say it's the rule and not the exception. I can count on my fingers the number of movement people I've known down through the years whose families would even still speak to them, never mind who were in any way supportive, even to the point of allowing their erring racist relatives to come over for dinner on occasion. Of course, a lot of that is due to the fact that the families are afraid that in a world controlled by Jews and liberals, they'll be tainted or financially impacted by their racial relatives' wicked ways, since political correctness has always been very big on guilt by association, accursed under the seventh generation, that kind of thing. That appears to be part of what happened to my own brother, who tried to make a career in drama in New York and who got blacklisted because of me, although beyond that I'm not going to get into my own family situation. I still try to maintain at least some basic sense of ethics about my public comments on personal matters, even if my brothers don't. Again, Mark, you have to simply accept the way the world is and accept that certain things come with the territory. When I was in Ireland, a senior IRA man was being interviewed by some liberal magazine or other, and the female reporter was berating him for making orphans out of the children of British soldiers and RUC officers and IRA bomb and gun victims, and the IRA man replied, "I will not be blackmailed by the tears of children into failing in my duty to my country." That is to some extent the attitude we have to take. I will not be blackmailed by the members of my family into failing in my duty to my race, because that duty is in fact more important than any personal or family consideration. Because if you fail in that duty, you are raising your sons to be slaves and your daughters to be whores for niggers. And I mean that. The way things are going, that is most likely to be quite literally the case. Suppose you have young children right now. What kind of world do you think they're going to live in when they're 21, when they're 40? What will their lives be like if they even make it to 65 or 70? Is that the kind of world and the kind of life that you want for them? If not, then it is your moral obligation, not just to the rest of us, but to your own progeny, to quit screwing around and get on with the job of solving this terrible problem through removing the people who are causing the problem from state power, which is the only way it can be done. If you really care for your children, you will stop screwing around, tapping on a keyboard and listening to podcasts on the internet, including this one, and tomorrow you will use that computer to start an internet search for jobs in the Pacific Northwest and to locate a good, inexpensive moving van service. Francis Parker Yockey wrote in Imperium, "This destiny does not tire, nor can it be broken, and its mantle of strength descends upon those in its service." The crux of it is, Mark, that if we wish to serve this destiny, as Yockey would have understood the term, we must become hard men, impervious to feelings, to desire, to regret, to anger, to any emotion. We have to become kind of a racist Mr. Spock. Everything must be sacrificed to the world to come, and we have to accept that this will leave little time or place in our hearts for the world that is past or the world as it is now. Okay, second music break. How many of you remember the old Andy Griffith Show? Ever seen any of those shows with the musical Hillbilly Family, headed by an old man named Briscoe Darling, who was played by Denver Pyle, and a bunch of really ethnic-looking young men who were supposed to be the Darling Boys? Well, that was a bluegrass band called the Dillards, and they did a song about those particular characters they played on TV. This is the Darling Boys. This is from Ed Peacock in North Carolina. Dear HAC, it's very simple. Everybody wants to see you on TV every night. You're not real unless you're on television. I know this allows the enemy to select and define who their opposition is to be, but this is the way Americans think. There are two worlds they live in, the one around them and the one they see on their TV and computer screens, and they prefer the one on the screen. I got a somewhat similar email from Miranda in, actually, I don't know where she's from, wanting to know why the Northwest Front doesn't have public rallies like the so-called NSM. Okay, let's talk about streetwalking and publicity. Some years ago, I wrote an article called The Streetwalking Rationale. I won't sit here and read it because it's too long and it's very boring listening to some old fart just sitting here reading a 10-year-old article, but I'll try to give you a quick rundown of the basics. One of the movement's most sacred cows is the streetwalk, otherwise known, almost always incorrectly, as a quote-unquote rally. These so-called rallies mostly consist of about 18 people, if we're lucky, and we're usually confronted with hundreds and sometimes thousands of counter-demonstrating garbage. Wildest one I ever went on was June the 26, 1978, Daly Plaza in Chicago, the Operation Skokie Victory Rally. There were 35 of us and about 50,000 Jew protesters. I tell you, you haven't lived until you stepped out onto a baking hot inner city square and heard the roar of 50,000 human beings who want to tear you limb from limb. We really did think we were going to be bringing dead bodies back from that one. Anyway, before I go off on to another long Grandpa Simpson ramble, let me explain the official rationale behind streetwalking, point by point. Streetwalking, in theory, is essentially an attempt to reproduce here in America certain objective conditions which apply to Europe today or which have applied to Europe in the past or which to a limited extent applied to America many years ago, such as the 50,000-man Klan marches of the 1920s, so forth and so on. The problem is that we're trying to reproduce the conditions and symbols of past times without the people of past times. We are essentially speaking to our great-grandfathers again, but our great-grandfathers aren't around anymore. All we've got is Beavis and Butthead and Clueless, and they simply do not understand at all the same message that our great-grandparents would have picked up on immediately. More specifically, streetwalking is an attempt to replicate, here in the 21st century, certain key periods in European history which provided windows of opportunity for revolution, specifically Weimar Germany and, to a lesser extent, Petrograd in 1917 for leftists. The commies have this same obsession as well, by the way. We seem to think it's Germany in 1933, and they seem to think it's always St. Petersburg in 1917. It's a form of what anthropologists call sympathetic magic. The belief is that if we emulate the behavior of certain political movements from these historical epochs, wave the flags and put on the costumes of the period, that sort of thing, then somehow the year 2010 will become these historical epochs. Here's how it's supposed to work in theory. First, we begin with a tiny number of people who are willing to appear in public at all, and I do mean tiny. As most of you know, I recently started up a public list on Northwest Revolution where people can voluntarily list their email address and their state and area of residence so that they can set up physical personal meetings. Our email list now numbers about 1,500 people, which I have no problem in discussing since I'm sure the FBI knows as much from monitoring my every keystroke. Of those 1,500 people, more or less, all of 57 have so far volunteered to actually personally meet other racially conscious white people in their area. Now, that's maybe 3% of the list. The other 97% are cowering and hiding behind their computers. Basically, we're terrified. We're a mass of frightened rabbits. Zach Hatfield and Cody Brock and Shane Ryan may be out there somewhere, but I'm damned if there's any sign of them yet. Anyway, for these streetwalks, we get together a small group of the t-shirt youth, the young men with nothing but the t-shirts on their back, who've already been thrown away by America, and so they don't have anything to lose by showing their butts in public, plus a few older right-wing cranks. Then this small handful of people goes out in public, often oddly dressed, waving signs and flags from the various historical epochs they're trying to invoke, Confederate flags, Third Reich War flags, Lion of Scotland flags, whatever, trying to pretend that they're really Confederate soldiers or Nazi stormtroopers, or William Wallace instead of Beavis and Butthead and the comic book guy from The Simpsons. They have to be protected from the anti-fas by the police, which of course is absolutely disgraceful. They stand there and get pelted with insults and garbage from various Reds, Mud People, Bugger Boys, etc., while the television cameras roll and we look really, really lame and weak and stupid, unable to raise a hand in our own defense. Now, the theory is that other white people will see this publicity, admire the hell out of us, and come clamoring to join our grouplets and go on the next such activity. Now, why anyone would respect a group who stands there and lets themselves be abused and insulted and assaulted has always escaped me, but apparently we don't seem to be able to think things through that far. All we see is the TV cameras. After every one of these events, there's always a big rush back to the motel or whoever's house we're using as an assembly point to watch the news and see who got on TV. The problem with that is that Zog and the media controls how much and what, if anything, the white population is allowed to see and hear of such activities. We are presented not as news, but as entertainment, which is what the masses, or the masses, as an old wobbly called them, expect from their television. Look at the funny racists in the funny clothes. Now stay tuned for American Idol. Does this mean we would get any better results if all the streetwalkers wore suits and ties? No, it doesn't. That's been tried. Too. When we wear suits and ties, then they ignore us completely. The unwritten but ironclad rule is that if we're not making fools of ourselves by making ourselves look strange or tattooed or shaven-headed or drunk or yelling obscenities or holding up signs saying gas Jews or such stupid crap, no TV cameras. The publicity always focuses on how we look rather than on what we say. Visual rather than verbal content. Now, this is one reason that I will only do media interviews by email. I don't do a lot of interviews, as you can guess. Secondly, there is, again, that issue of white character, which we refuse to address. The fact is that the overwhelming majority of white people are simply morally incapable of giving us the kind of reaction that we seek from them through this kind of activity. We are speaking to their great-grandfathers, not to them. White Americans simply don't get propaganda of the deed, even when it's violent and bloody. In February, Joe Stack flew his own plane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas, and the great pale blob out there in TV land just said, "Nyeh," and changed the channel looking for Dancing with the Stars. It is useless to appeal to the nobler nature and better instincts of the white majority. They have none. They've been deliberately engineered that way. They will never respond to any kind of mass movement tactics because the necessary moral instincts, frames of reference, and cultural motivations have been socially engineered out of them. We're beating a dead horse. The fact is that we are not going to be able to beat this evil tyranny with any kind of symbolic act. It's going to have to be the real thing. If they are ever going to be dragged out of their carpeted offices and their executive boardrooms and their fancy trendy clubs and restaurants, then we're going to have to go in and dig them out by force like moray eels. As an interesting digression, while Sinn Féin does hold demonstrations regularly in Ireland, A, they have the many thousands in numbers needed to do it right, and B, the actual volunteers of the IRA are under orders to stay away from such events to prevent their being photographed or arrested. The only exceptions are firing parties at Republican funerals, although I understand the provost stopped doing that because it was too risky. I must admit, I like my own little aphorism. A white man of 20 who doesn't streetwalk has no balls. If he's still doing it when he's 40, he has no brain. Okay, it's now 2010. We've been doing these tiny little rallies, so-called, for a good 50 years now. Where are the results? Where are the visible results of any of it, anything we've done for the past 50 years? How much actual political, racial, or demographic change has come about from any of it? I ask you, point blank, is this what we need to be spending the next 20 years doing? In view of the fact that it's probably the last 20 years we'll have. Again, I say, it is time for us to sit down, reassess, and rethink all of this. Okay, third music break. Now, you just know I have to have my Irish mellows in here somewhere. This is Artie McGlynn. Thank you. The next email comes from a comrade in New York whom I won't name because I don't want to embarrass him or have him feel like I'm targeting him in any way. The fact is that his viewpoint is a very common one in the racially conscious community. Dear HAC, you know, maybe it is all a hobby and a waste of time. Don't worry, I'm not going to stop supporting you because you're right, it is the right thing to do. I can't do much for you, but what I can do, I will. But I don't expect any results. I'm sorry, I just don't believe that we can win. Well, I could go off into a long digression on history and economics and all kinds of other subjects to demonstrate that it is indeed possible for us to win. But the fact is that in the final analysis, whether we win or not is going to depend entirely on two groups of people, the white people who are with us and the white people who are against us. So what I'm going to do now is to speak directly to both of those groups of people. I'm not going to try and say anything to niggers or faggots or Jews who might be listening to this podcast, because they don't matter. Niggers are genetically incapable of understanding anything I say, so there's no point in my wasting my breath on them. Faggots are mentally ill, and so, ditto, they're incapable of understanding, and I won't waste my time. Jews can understand what I'm saying. They certainly have the intelligence, but since they're incapable of change and beyond all bounds of acceptable human parameters in any case, there's no point in my trying to get through to them. I mean, it's not like they're going to stop being kikes because of my brilliant oratory any more than a snake can decide not to be a snake anymore. As always, when it really boils down to the nitty-gritty, the coming conflict in the Northwest is going to be a civil war between whites caused by the presence on this continent of non-whites, just like the first one. First, I want to address the people who are listening to these podcasts who will be among the Northwest Republic's enemies. Right at the moment, judging from our stat counter, that's mostly going to be cops of various sorts, FBI, Homeland Security, Secret Service listening in hope that I'll threaten President Sotoro so they can arrest me, that kind of thing. There also may be a few condescending liberals and whacked-out college punk neo-Marxist types listening in. To you, I would start off by saying that I imagine you're all pretty confident. After all, any rational observer would say that your side has all the cards. You've got way more manpower than we've got. You've got the largest arsenal in the world on your side, from your 9mm sidearms up to the nuclear weapons and sarin nerve gas you've got stashed away. You've got the world's largest source of money, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. taxpayer base. If all else fails, or if you just want to save yourself some bother, you could probably buy all of us off for $1 million apiece. A few might refuse. I like to think I would, but hey, if you decide you want to go that route, give me a shout. It would at least be nice to be asked. You've got all the mainstream media, of course, although you don't control the internet yet, and that may turn out to be one of your major weaknesses. You've got the courts and the prisons and the whole economy and all the established churches and Arianna Huffington and John Stewart to back you up, so you may be laughing at me right now and say, hey, how can we lose? But you will. Oh yeah, you're going to lose. Eventually. Okay, maybe not to us. Maybe we'll fail and there won't ever be any Northwest Republic. I have to admit that when only 57 people out of 1,500 on an email list are willing to even meet with another white nationalist in person, and the other 1,443 are cowering behind their computer terminals in terror, that doesn't look good for our team. If those 1,500 people were all real white men, like our great-grandparents, there would be a different story, but they aren't, and it's not. And yet still, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that eventually all of you assholes in your silk suits, sitting in your cubicles listening, waiting for me to make a slip you can arrest and prosecute me for, you're going to lose, and your whole world is going to come crashing down into rubble like ancient Carthage, another Semitic empire that didn't make it. Not even like ancient Rome, because when Rome finally went down, they left behind far more that endured than you wretched little Americans ever will. All you'll leave behind is a lot of Styrofoam McDonald's hamburger boxes. You're going to lose for several very good, very solid reasons. The first reason you're going to lose is because you're incompetent. You're idiots. You couldn't organize a piss-up in a brewery. After almost 10 years of hunting, billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dead on all sides, you cannot find a single man hiding in a cave in Afghanistan. Your mighty army and your swaggering hoorah marines cannot defeat a handful of ragged little barefoot brown men with nothing but Kalashnikovs and a few magazines of ammo apiece. You will expend a $20 million Predator drone missile in order to blow up an elementary school in Iraq or a wedding in Afghanistan. You can't even run an efficient postal service. You can't pass a major piece of legislation like healthcare without resorting to open public bribery. Your so-called leader right now is a stupid nigger who literally cannot address a classroom full of school children without a teleprompter to tell him what to say. Barry has accomplished something that 2 years ago I would have considered to be impossible. He has actually managed to make George W. Bush look able and intelligent by comparison. Yes, yes, I know, Barry doesn't really run the show down there at 1600 Pennsylvania. Rahm Emanuel and all those Jews do. But still, what does it say about your world and your society that you cannot even keep up appearances anymore? Your available field of candidates for these high-profile jobs no longer contains much of anyone who's not mentally subnormal or a clown or a criminal or some kind of pervert like that twinkle-toes senator from Idaho who cruises airport men's rooms looking to suck a little strange cock. You can no longer produce any presidential candidates who are even mediocrities. They're all genuinely stupid men. In Jug Ears and Barry's case, breathtakingly so. Why exactly is it that you put that silly black creature in the White House? Can your world, your way, honest to God, not come up with anything better than Barry Satoro? Was it sheer Jewish arrogance, their way of rubbing the rest of our noses in the fact that they're openly in charge now? If so, was that really a very intelligent or far-seeing move on their part? You see, you gotta understand, that's the thing about the Jews. They always overreach themselves. They always go too far. I suppose I could encapsulate this particular reason you're going to lose by saying that you're not fooling anybody anymore. Your world, your system is sick, weak, confused, barely functional, quavering with senility, and all the rest of the world knows it. America is still feared in certain quarters, true, although less and less. But no one respects you anymore. Now that leads into the second reason that you're going to lose. You Americans have lost the consent of the governed. Do you know that only 35% of the present U.S. population pays income tax? And that's the 35% you've lost, the third that counts. The people of this country, the real people, the white people who do the work and pay the taxes and keep the machinery and the technology running, don't want you anymore. I'm sure I'm not the only one you listen to as you sit in your cubicle or sit in a Starbucks in Georgetown listening to your laptop with a headset or however the hell it works. All these other people you're monitoring, the Tea Party and the militias, the birthers and the sovereign citizen people, the tax rebels and the survivalists, the skinheads, whatever's left of the Klan, the bloggers and the Council of Conservative Citizens, what are they all about, basically? What have they got in common? They're all looking for a way to get you and Barry and Rahm and Ben Bernanke and your whole way of life off their backs. The people of the North American continent, of the U.S. and Canada, the real people, the white people, not the millions of non-productive brown scum, want you and your government and your laws and your arrogance gone, out of their lives. They're not sure how yet, and maybe the Northwest Front won't be the ones they turn to if we can't get our act together. That's on us. But listen very hard to me, all of you morally denatured droids with guns and badges and the expensive suits who hear my voice. As sick and destitute, as isolated and alone as I am, I speak for the real people of America. You no longer do. I speak for history. You speak for nobody except that pathetic primate in the White House and his little Jewish handlers. And I am telling you, we don't want you anymore. We want you gone. And when millions of white people want something bad enough, history usually finds a way to give it to us. Now, the third reason that you're going to lose is simple. We are right, and you are wrong. Okay, granted, with that and a dollar, I can buy a cup of coffee. But it sure as hell doesn't hurt. You're making a fundamental mistake that tyrants always make. You think that you can destroy an idea by destroying the people who believe in it. You think that if you can just imprison or eventually kill enough of us, the ideas of freedom and racial pride in our white heritage will disappear. But human beings and human events don't work like that. You can't infiltrate an idea. You can't put it in prison with informers and wiretaps and perjured testimony and fabricated evidence. You can't shoot an idea. That's been tried so often in the past 200 years that I'm sure even historical illiterates like you can probably recall some examples of that failure if you put your minds to it. I'm not saying that our idea is stronger than yours. I'm saying that we have one and you don't. As stumbling and confused and hesitant as we are, at least so far, we do what we do for reasons of the heart and the mind and the soul. You do what you do for money. Sure, money can beat us for a time. It has so far, and it'll beat us for a while yet, but not forever. You may wonder why I play this music I play on here. It's not just to provide my listeners with some relief from my hoarse, babbling voice. It is to show my own people what we have that makes us better than you. That music is us, not you. And because we are capable of creating it and understanding and feeling it in ourselves, we are going to win and you are going to lose. Now I want to talk to the second group of people who will someday decide the fate of our new Northwest Nation, a much smaller group of people, the white men and women who are with us now and who will be with us when the time comes. Now you ask me how you can change, how you can become the kind of men and women who will one day beat these bastards who are listening in and watching us down into the dust and rip their hearts out. As long as I am allowed to do so, I will be presenting you with all kinds of ways I think this can be done over and over and over again, but here's tonight's offering on the subject. There are two things holding you back, fear and ego. You must banish both from your mind, your heart, and your soul, because if you try to carry them into battle, you won't make it, and you will bring others down with you. You must listen to the voice that speaks inside the mind, the voice that tells you what you must do, the voice that you have been conditioned all your life to suppress and to ignore. The fact is that there is no one single guaranteed way for you to cleanse yourself of fear and of ego and the narcissism of America. It's different with every individual, but it does require a strong and disciplined act of will. When you're trying to quit smoking or drinking or some other bad bodily habit, it's a case of mind over matter. This is a case of mind over mind, and that's a lot harder. Some people simply can't do it. I get that. But we don't need for everybody to do it. We only need about 1,000 men and women out of all the millions of white people still on this continent to accomplish this mental and spiritual transfiguration. Once we get that core group here in the homeland and get them organized as the first true Northwest Volunteers, it will become comparatively easy to pick up the next few thousand we'll need, and with that small force of absolutely dedicated people, we can beat whatever Zion throws at us. How will you know when you do accomplish it? You'll know. White people live in fear all the time, and fear is a form of pain. If you're in pain all the time, you may reach the point where you don't even know it anymore. But once the pain is gone, then you damn sure know it. Ego and narcissism are harder to control because, unlike fear, they're natural components of the human mind and personality, and very few people can ever suppress them completely. But you don't have to suppress them completely, just enough for you to be able to act as part of a team to get this most important of all the jobs in history done. Fear and doubt, ego and pride, these are what stand in our way. They are strong, but they're not invincible. And just as a lion tamer can subdue and control the big cats, you can subdue and control the part of you that prevents our people from resisting. All I can suggest is that from this moment on, you make a conscious decision. No, I will not live in fear any longer. No, it's not all about me. You have that strength within you. It's your inheritance from the thousands of generations of our people who have gone before. The Jews have robbed you of much that is rightfully yours, but they have not robbed you of that inner strength. It is there within you if you will finally make the decision to use it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.